morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian President Joseph Boakai vows key reforms in his first State of the Nation address.
I am hereby declaring drugs and substance abuse as public health emergency. In this fight, me and my vice president will be the first to take drug tests. And I urge all others to follow me.
Malawi launches a new COVID-19 vaccination campaign amid rising cases. Zimbabwe's ruling party spokesperson refutes allegations that he's caused the causing divisions in the main opposition. There's cautious optimism for peace in Africa's Great Lakes region.
We are infinitely better off today than we were 10 years ago. And so on that trajectory, I'm hoping that it's in everyone's interest that we certainly do not go back to where we were 10 or 20 years ago.
And Kenya fails to enroll all children in secondary school. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's President Joseph Boakai declares drugs and substance abuse a public health emergency as he highlights the importance of the rule of law in his first State of the Nation address. Denise Nipsey has more.
President Boakai, in his first State of the Nation address, says the country is in distress and that the proliferation of drug and substance abuse must be addressed. Several communities across the capital, Monrovia, and its environs report that scores of young people have died and continue to be affected due to the use of kuch, an illicit form of the indica strain of cannabis.
The drug epidemic, especially the use of kuch in our country, is an existential threat, even away the future of our children in the country. I am hereby declaring drug and substance abuse as public health emergency. I am establishing a multi-sectorial steering committee comprising the following divisions. In this fight, me and my vice president will be the first to take drug test, and I urge all others to follow me.
In the message, they capture his administration's vision, agriculture, roads, rule of law, education, sanitation, and tourism, or arrest for short. Boakai stressed the need for a lasting solution to economic instability and unemployment.
We intend to change the state of economy by thinking outside the box, a paradigm shift away from reliance on our primary commodity export, to focusing on value addition with the private sector as an engine to drive the economy. Under my administration, the empowerment of the Liberian entrepreneurship through more support will help bring back the Made in Liberia quest, inclusive and sustainable growth and jobs.
Meanwhile, President Boakai criticized the former administration's management of the economy.
The report of U.S. $40 million as the GOL's consolidated account balance as of January 19, 2024 is not supported either. The balance reported by the CBL as of the same date was $20.5 million, highly encumbered, not $40 million. To this end, we will reemphasize our earlier commitment to audit across all branches of government, not only the executive.
Anosy Meme is the executive director for the Center for Transparency and Accountability in Liberia. He is hopeful that President Boakai's promises will not be just mere talk.
We can only hope that those things that he said he would do, because we've seen people making promises over time, and in terms of fulfillment of those promises, it hasn't really been positive for the presidents we've had before, the leaders we've had before. So President Weah, for example, made several promises to deal with corruption, prosecuting his officials and those accused of corruption.
Some Liberians are disappointed the president did not address the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in his first State of the Nation address. They also hope he and his officials will declare their assets as soon as possible. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsey in Monrovia, Liberia.
Mali and Burkina Faso said Monday that they had sent ECOWAS a formal notice of their withdrawal from the West African bloc, with Niger expected to follow. The military regimes in all three countries had announced plans to withdraw from the West African bloc, accusing ECOWAS of posing a threat to their sovereignty. The Foreign Affairs Ministry in Mali showed French news agency the AFP a copy of the letter it sent to ECOWAS, while Burkina Faso's official news agency reported it had sent an official notice. No information emerged from Niger, but the statements from its two neighbors stressed the common character of their move. ECOWAS said earlier in a statement that it was awaiting formal and direct notification from the countries. Under the bloc's statute, withdrawal cannot take effect for at least a year after official notification. Regional powerhouse Nigeria issued a statement late Monday expressing sadness over the three countries' decision of departure from the bloc, which it hosts. The former U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa says he's hopeful the leaders in the region will peacefully resolve political feuds and harsh rhetoric that have flared up recently. J.P. DeFarm, who is also a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., is cautious that sustainable engagement from both regional leaders and the international community is necessary to achieve long-lasting peace in the region.
Certainly, without justifying it or defending it, it's understandable that in the heat of electoral campaigns, the Democratic Republic of the Congo just finished a presidential and legislative election season. Rwanda is approaching elections this year. So in the midst of all that, it's understandable politically that rhetoric sometimes soars. That's not necessarily helpful diplomatically, but it's politically understandable. What is to be hoped for is that once campaigns are finished, that leaders will hopefully dial back the rhetoric and engage with each other constructively. But obviously, the danger persists, and there are multiple conflicts and tensions across the region that are certainly not helpful for peace and security, much less for development. And what's needed is diplomatic engagement on a sustained level to ensure that the hard-won peace and security and stability of recent years is not lost.
So you are hopeful that the situation is going to get better after the elections and after all those other, you know, factors, right?
I remain cautiously. I take a long view. I've been engaged in this region for many years, both as a scholar and an analyst, but also as the U.S. government's special envoy for the region. So my experience of the region, I take the long view. We are infinitely, no matter how you look at it, better off today than we were 10 years ago. And so on that trajectory, I'm hoping that it's in everyone's interest that we certainly do not go back to where we were 10 or 20 years ago. So in that sense, I'm hopeful that good sense will prevail, but that's going to require hard work on the part of leaders in the region, but also their international partners.
What can those leaders in the region do specifically to just calm down the situation?
Well, I think we all understand it happens everywhere. It happens, to be fair. It happens in Europe. It happens in America. During campaigns, lots of things are said to fire up one's base, to score points against one's opponent. But after the heat of campaigns, one hopes that one gets back to the business of governance. So that's my hope, at least. But in order to do that, one has to have goodwill on the part of the leaders of the region. One also has to have support from the international community, and I cannot emphasize this enough, sustained engagement. I applaud the fact that various governments, including that of the United States, have engaged at very senior levels in the interest of promoting peace and security and calming down tensions. But it takes more than one-off engagements or one or two high-level visits.
Former U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, J.P. DeFarm, was speaking with Frederick Kundikeji of VOA Central Africa Service. J. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 30th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Zimbabwe's War Veterans Minister and ruling ZANU-PF party spokesperson Chris Muzvangwa has refuted allegations by the former leader of the main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, Nelson Chamisa, that President Emmerson Mnangagwa is behind the factional fights in the opposition. Chamisa resigned from the CCC last week, accusing President Mnangagwa of hijacking the party and using the country's courts to destabilize the opposition. However, in this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service, Muzvangwa says while the ruling party benefits from the disintegration of the opposition, it is not involved in the chaos.
Well, look, this is politics. It is important that the political organizations be strong enough to insulate themselves from any wayward interference in their affairs. So, look, you know, because it's a game of political contestation, it's a power, game of power. You know, we cannot expect it to be a church service on Sunday. It's not a Roman mass politics. But by the same token, it's not ZANU membership which is inside the CCC, infiltrated inside CCC. It's discontented membership within the CCC which is settling scores among themselves.
Writing on his Facebook page, Mr. Chamisa is alleging that there are attempts on his life. What is your take on this?
Well, you know, if he's scared, that's, you know, a very serious issue. Subjectively or otherwise, if he's scared, you know, Chamisa has got every right to go to the next police station near him, because we want everybody's life protected. Life is sacrosanct in Zimbabwe, regardless of who you are. You are a Zimbabwean citizen, you are entitled to the full protection of the Zimbabwean rule. So should he feel anxious about his life, for whatever reason, subjectively or otherwise, let him go to the next police station. All these years when he was in active politics, the police was protecting him and there was no danger to him. Why should he be now that he has quit politics in the CCC? Why would anybody want to threaten him? Because he's no longer holding on to anything which anyone may covet. Being a non-leader of a political party outside of it makes him any potential enemies be very dangerous, which we don't believe they are. They have no particular interest now to pursue a quarry which has abandoned the base.
Some critics are saying that what is happening in Zimbabwe is probably what is leading to some coups in some African countries, in that there is the opposition is suppressed, elections are allegedly rigged, and this causes instability.
Those are misplaced and very disingenuous accusations. We have a constitutional democracy where the constitution was approved after being worked upon by the two parties in it, ZANU-PF and the ex-CCC MTC. Our laws operate and people go for elections and people win elections. That's why we have ZANU-PF MPs and we have MTC MPs who have been sworn in parliament. So the constitutional order in Zimbabwe is operating very well. We have no history of abusive internal imposition of leaders like what happened in West Africa, where the French now are finding themselves in an individual's position vis-à-vis their former colonies. We don't have any. So we have no internal party grievances which can cause anybody to try to compare to us to anything which is happening in West Africa. No.
Chris Muzvangwa, Zimbabwe's war veterans minister and ruling ZANU-PF spokesperson, he was speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. The Malawi government and the World Health Organization launched a new COVID-19 vaccination campaign on Monday in 10 of the country's 29 districts. This is partly in response to new cases confirmed in the past 3 weeks in several districts across the country. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Nsanje district in southern Malawi currently leads in the number of COVID-19 cases recorded this year. George Mbotwa is the spokesperson for the district health office. He told VOA that the district has registered 17 new cases in the past 3 weeks. Some are health workers.
Actually, we have registered more health workers. Initially, there were two, and we had up to 8 cases that were health workers. Some of them have been confirmed negative, and some are still being followed up to ensure that they are fully recovered before they can resume work.
By Monday, Malawi cumulatively recorded 89,202 confirmed COVID-19 cases, including 2,686 deaths since the first cases were confirmed in the country in March 2020. Malawi's Ministry of Health says the new vaccination campaign will help boost the number of people getting the COVID-19 vaccine. Vaccination rates in some areas of Malawi are as low as 40%. It also says the WHO-funded campaign would help avoid waste of the vaccine, as was the case in 2020 when the government destroyed nearly 20,000 expired AstraZeneca doses. Much of those doses expired due to vaccine hesitancy amid concerns of its safety and efficacy. However, recent government public health campaigns on the importance of COVID-19 jabs have helped defeat that hesitancy. Mary Chawingam is a mother of two based in Majinjiri Township in Blanta.
I have already taken one. I am waiting for a booster, and I'm ready to take my children because the prevention is better than cure, they say. You never know what the wave will be like this time around, considering the way it was way back in 2020. I've had it in 2020, and now this is 2024.
Another mother of two, Habiba Nyasuru, says she received the COVID-19 doses during the first campaign and encourages others to get the jab.
But I know that we are not safe until everyone is safe. So let others also receive the vaccine. I know that the vaccine doesn't prevent us from getting infected, but it helps us when we contract it not to be critically ill.
Maziko Matemba is a community health care ambassador in Malawi.
The threat for COVID is still with us. Malawi didn't vaccinate the required number of people against COVID-19 because the targeted population was about 11 million Malawians. But we were less than half, about 2 or 3 million who were able to get vaccinated.
Matemba says the country now needs to have the vaccine in the right places and encourage more people to get vaccinated. The Minister of Health says the new campaign targets 10 out of the country's 29 health districts that have recently recorded new cases. These include Machingam, Blanta, Lowa, Nzimba, and Nsanje districts. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
The school year is well underway across Kenya, but education officials say not every high school-aged student has made it to class. Mohammed Yusuf investigates why enrollment is less than 100%.
Social media pages in Kenya are filled with primary school graduates holding placards asking well-wishers to help them with school fees to continue their education. Some have received help from ordinary citizens and businesses, and some politicians have come forward to help. However, more than 2 weeks after secondary school classes began, some 10% of an estimated 1.3 million students who passed last year's high school entrance exams still haven't made it into the classroom. The Kenyan government has begun pushing for a 100% transition from primary to secondary school, but some learners are finding it difficult to continue their education for financial reasons. Lucy Njau is a guardian to one boy, a teenager who scored 345 out of 500 required marks on the entrance exams. Njau says she's so poor she cannot afford the required fees, uniform and books, 50,000 shillings, $350 to send one boy to school. Njau says if I want to take her to school, I will spend 50,000 shillings, including all the school requirements and even school uniforms that I cannot afford. Laikipia, Nyeri, Samburu counties recorded a 99% transition rate, with the capital Nairobi along with Nakuru and Wajir counties recording 98%. The high attendance rate in Wajir, a county in northern Kenya, comes even as schools and teachers there have faced attacks by the Al-Shabaab militant group. Kajiado, Narok, Isiolo and Kilifi counties have recorded lower enrollments ranging from 64 to 79%. Meshak Oduke is the head teacher of Shills Secondary School in Nairobi. He says most parents cannot pay the required fees to keep their children in class.
The biggest factor is in school fees. Many parents are unable to raise the expected money. And if you look at the fees for extra county schools, it's about 50,000. Now, if these parents are coming from humble backgrounds, it's not going to be easy for this parent to raise this money to pay. Another factor is that there are those parents who are not ready to allow their children to be moved from one area to another, and that one is also affecting the 100 transition.
The Kenyan government provides some financial assistance to students in need of aid, but the biggest chunk is left for parents to pay. Critics say the system is riddled with favoritism and corruption, locking out the neediest. Aduke says the government should rethink the way it channels education money meant to help poor students.
The government should come up with a program where all these monies can be put in one basket. Then this money can be sent into schools after identifying the needy students and those ones that are not needy. Because we end up sponsoring or giving this money to the students who are already able to pay for themselves. And those ones who are unable to pay, they remain at home.
Kenyan officials have warned schools against turning away students due to school fees. But many school teachers complain of a lack of money to run the school, as just a few students complete their payments on time. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States on Monday offered a reward of up to $5 million for the arrest of a former Sudanese official sought over alleged Darfur war crimes who escaped prison as charges grow of new atrocities. Ahmed Haroun, a former top aide to the post-dictator Omar al-Bashir, is wanted by the International Criminal Court, the ICC, for helping form the notorious Janjaweed militia, which carried out a scorched earth campaign in Darfur in the 2000s. The United States pointed out that Janjaweed has evolved into the Rapid Support Forces, which is accused of ethnic-based attacks against the non-Arab population in Western Sudan. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has accused the Rapid Support Forces of crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing in the latest bloodshed. Addressing the UN Security Council on Monday, ICC prosecutor Karim Khan says it was his clear assessment that both sides were carrying out crimes in Darfur. And that's it for this Tuesday, January 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and Add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America.